Welcome to Gentle Horror Weekly, episode 16, recorded July 1st, 2016. Elastic Elephants. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Channel Pro Weekly, number 16, if I got my count right. And joining me this week, me as in Matt Whitlock, technology editor and podcast semi-host for your show today. But joining me are the more important people in this podcast, editor-in-chief and all-around fabulous gal, Ms. Cecilia Galvin.
Hola!
And I'm going to call him king of the channel this time.
Oh, good. Nice.
And also nice. The king of the sport jacket and jeans look, senior news editor, Rich Freeman.
Hey there.
So I'm excited about this show, guys. I think we got a lot of really cool stuff to talk about. One topic that's very near and dear to my heart, which we'll get to shortly, but I got a pretty fun museum pick that goes right along with that. I've got a hardware pick, and we've got some big stories to talk about. As well as speaking of big stories, Cecilia, why don't we just go ahead and dive right in to what the big story you're working on that is hitting the site tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow is July 1st, and that's when we go live with our Reader's Choice Awards. And this is the only SMB-focused awards in the channel. And our readers, we had more than 500 readers cast their ballots for their favorite vendors who produce solutions that are great for their customers and good for their own businesses. So this is a big deal for us at Channel Pro. And, you know, as we say, forget about that other election coming in November. This is the vote that matters in the SMB channel. This is it. So we go through and ask lots and lots of intriguing questions about who the best of the best are in SMB technology. You're going to find out who wins managed services awards, like best RMM vendor, best professional services automation vendor. We go on and talk about quoting solutions. We have lots of cloud virtualization awards to give out, and these are win, place, and show. So check out the website tomorrow. They'll be live. And you find out, if you're a vendor and you're listening, maybe you've won.
Do you think for our best firewall category, I should use a picture of Donald Trump?
Just best wall.
Best wall.
Oh, we didn't have that, but.
No, but I think there's a security or firewall appliance one in there, maybe. You never know. I might be able to find a way to stick a few fun political pictures in there, just for good times.
Good times.
We added some new awards this year, too.
True.
We're handing out first-time awards, I think, for RMM PSA Suite, I know, is one of them. But there are two others, maybe? I can't remember what they are.
Your award. You should know. Although I should know, because I should have had the coverage all up on the site by now, and I already made the little picture that goes with it. But
well, I know
clearly we know I'm going to wait till the very last minute to get all that stuff up.
I remembered another one here is Cloud Computing Marketplace.
Oh, right. Yes, lots of marketplaces.
Yeah. There are
that crosses over from vendors to distributors.
Awesome. And there's the component awards in there too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
So all of those doomahickuses that go to build a PC from nothingness, those awards are in there as well. Motherboards, memory, optical drives. Did we take out optical drives? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we probably did.
But there is still graphics cards and processors and all kinds of good nerdy things for those who think hardware like me. So 500. That's a pretty good. That's a pretty good turnout.
Yeah, more than 500. I was very pleased. Very, very pleased. It just goes to show, you know, readers are enthusiastic about these because it gives them a chance to voice their opinion for their vendors, give them a vote of confidence and whatnot, and I think that that's important. I think the channel's just like that.
Yeah, so most likely by the time this, if you're listening to this, I almost guarantee that the results are out and public. So go ahead and start peeking through them, and then next week, what do you say, Cecilia and Rich, we dive into some of the awards, you know, the actual winners, maybe talk about any surprises or any non-surprises.
Sure.
Next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great.
All right, cool. So, Rich, I understand that there's an elephant in the room. I hope it's in your room and not in mine, because I don't think my floor up here in my office can take the weight of an elephant.
Yeah, well, same here, but last Friday I was in a much, much bigger room than this office I'm recording from, at a hotel near the SeaTac airport here in the Seattle area, attending the second day of a two-day Logic Now conference, which was very interesting. I had a really great day there. I met some interesting channel pros, got to hear some great content from Logic Now and some folks that they brought in. And I put a story up on our website on Monday about that. And the best part, and this is what we're kind of alluding to here, is, and now I gotta make absolutely certain that I pronounce her name correctly, but the host of the event was Logic Now's community manager, Nadia Karatsourios. I hope I am pronouncing
that
correctly. Yes.
Very good.
I just call her Nadia because I could never pronounce her last name.
A familiar face to us, a familiar face, I think, to a lot of people, actually, in the channel. She was the host, the master of ceremonies for this event last Friday. So she came out, you know, at the beginning of the day, took the stage with this stuffed elephant in her hands. And practically the first words out of her mouth were, "Let's address the elephant in the room."
That's a great opener.
I thought it was a really clever way to deal with what was, you know, the obvious topic on everybody's mind, which was Logic Now being acquired by SolarWinds just a few weeks ago. You got a room full of Logic Now partners there. You would assume they're going to be kind of interested in this, curious about this. And so right out of the gate, she sort of said, "Let's talk about the elephant in the room." Now, I will say from that point forward, she really didn't have a whole lot to say about it. I mean, it was pretty clear that Logic Now really didn't want to dedicate a lot of time to that topic. So she basically just sort of said at that point that, look, all you need to know is this is just going to make our products even better than they were before, because we have access to all these additional resources, and let's just go out and continue being successful together. And then she moved on. And the event mostly focused on Mac management, managing Apple devices and security and machine learning and you know, the stuff that they really kind of want to talk to their partners about. But I thought it was good. It was worthy of applause that they were willing to say something about this topic. They did it right at the beginning of the day, and then they, you know, they moved on. Later that afternoon, I got an interview opportunity with Chris Groot, who is the vice president of their BDR group, and he spoke a little bit more about it with me. And I mean, his message was basically the same as hers. Is this is not, you know, I think the way he put it basically was, it would be kind of silly for us, and sillier still for SolarWinds, to mess with success, basically, right? It's like, we have something that's working. Why would we screw around with it? That was kind of the logic of the topic as he explained it to me. So that's what they're saying right now to their partners. And one quick little additional thought is just based on a few sort of random conversations with attendees at the show, I was actually kind of struck by how not nervous, how calm, basically, they all were about the new parent ownership for Logic Now. I expected to anticipate a little bit more anxiety, you know, especially among satisfied Logic Now partners. Well, I hope they don't change these products I like, and I did not detect a lot of concern about it.
Well, that maybe Logic Now has really done a good job with its partners in allaying their fears.
Yeah, and or, you know, they've also maybe just established a good track record over the years, mm-hmm. Of being forthright and not surprising them very often. So maybe, you know, they get a benefit.
And the fact that they've changed their business name like 4 times in the last 2 years, that kind of goes a long way to helping too.
Been there, right. Done that, right?
They have, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, partners are not concerned.
Right. This is another name.
It was a strategy leading up to this acquisition. So, you know, good for them.
No, you know, honestly, I don't think, in this case, I really don't think resellers or partners have a lot really to be worried about. Logic Now makes great stuff. They've been on a huge trajectory with their products lately. And I don't think SolarWinds is going to do anything to derail the efforts and the success that Logic Now has had over the last year.
And the other thing, and this was something Groot pointed out as well, and other people have pointed out, is Enable's product line, the SolarWinds Enable product line and the Logic Now product line are very similar, but in certain ways they're sort of complementary. They don't target exactly the same segments of the managed services space, and Enable has more of a sort of IT department business that Logic Now doesn't. So it's not as if you look at these two product sets and immediately think, oh my goodness, there's a lot of overlap there and something's got to go, you know. It stands to reason that a few years down the road there might be some sort of integration rationalization, but, you know, these are reasonably complementary product suites.
And you would think that with two complementary products in the RMM space that it would make both the Enable unit and the Logic Now unit just really up their game to keep, you know, to keep their products on the cutting edge. You know, nobody wants to be the division of the company that says, like, oh, you're not really performing very well. It's like they're just going to continue to innovate in their products like they've done all along.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, you're right, partly for concern about becoming redundant, basically, mm-hmm. expendable. But also because, you know, I'm sure there will be plenty of interest and pressure and so on from SolarWinds, yeah. and the folks on high to to keep adding value to these product lines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's also worth noting to our listeners that if you want to learn more about Logic Now's offering and products, they do a pre-day event. Like a pre-day training with our event. So I think in DC it's a technical training that they have coming up. I think you have to be a partner for that one. But if you are in Boston around November, they have like a pre-day workshop, and I think that's pretty much open to anybody, right?
I don't know how they broke that out for September and November.
Yeah, we got information on our event site about that. So go to events.channelpronetwork.com. And check out our Boston and DC area events that are coming up. And if you're interested in learning more about Logic Now and their Max product, you can check that out. And maybe there's a good fit for you to go and learn some stuff.
Right. And the pre-day is on September 13th with Logic Now.
Yep. Just make sure that's a so one of those is for existing partners, and I think one is for others. But check that out and, you know, sign up to be a partner and dive right in. They're a good group of people, and I think they give extra credit to anybody who actually learns how to properly pronounce Nadia's last name.
That's the drawing at the end. You get a prize.
Speaking of companies that are always evolving their product lines, Amazon's in the news this week, guys. Did you know that?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, Amazon. Amazon Web Services just launched their new Elastic File System, what they're calling Amazon EFS, which is a full managed services that lets you do fully scalable file storage in the AWS cloud, and that's scalable up and down. So how this differs from buying a giant pool of storage or whatever is that you basically only pay for what you use. So you create an account and you add your files, and your storage, the amount of storage that you have available to you, just kind of grows as you add storage to it and shrinks as you take storage away. So it's basically pay per use. This will be very good for people who are already using Amazon EC2, their compute cloud stuff, because it just works over the NFS v4 protocol. So your EC2 stuff can hit your new Elastic file storage pool. And you can have many clusters hitting it. It's got great speeds, and I can only imagine that this will eventually probably find its way into non-Amazon cloud services, like being able to hit this from like maybe like in a hybrid kind of environment. But for now, it's if you're using EC2 and you want Elastic file storage, they now have that available. So I don't know if there's any. I just wanted to kind of mention that in the news because for people who live in the cloud, this is good news for the Amazon folks.
So I mean, it's the way I have been thinking about it, which may or may not be correct, is basically this is an online, elastically priced NAS equivalent, network attached storage. It's a file storage system specifically, as opposed to block storage, which is for a very different kind of storage. Well, that S3 is sort of the equivalent of a cloud-based, elastically priced storage area network. This is like a network attached storage kind of.
So what it says here is that as mission critical workloads hit the cloud, a lot of workloads depend on network attached storage, and it's costly and time consuming to operate shared file systems because growth is unpredictable, procurement times long, monitoring and patch management are administrative burdens. EFS, you can create and use shared file systems that are simple, scalable, and reliable. So, Rich, I think you hit it right on the head. This is basically a big, giant cloud NAS that you don't have to manage. And with on-demand pricing. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So, Amazon's doing their whole Elastic File System thing. But, Cecilia, I know... you've got a new vendor that we should be keeping an eye on in the cybersecurity space. Is that right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about Black Stratus.
Black Stratus is a cool company that I just really learned more about. And the whole idea is that this kind of ties in a little bit to the upcoming audio that we have, the audio file that we have, it's related to security. And what Black Stratus does is it detects and identifies and then stops cybersecurity breaches with its new mid-market solution that they're calling CyberShark, and I thought that was a cool name. And what that is a fully managed white label offering for managed service providers. So this was the way I spoke with the guy's name is Dale Klein. I couldn't remember his first name there for a minute. I knew it was Klein. He kind of gave me a little bit of an example, and he said what makes the Black Stratus solution unique, and everybody wants to know what's a differentiator, right, is that it manages large data sets and it correlates information in real time. And he says, like other technologies, their solution sees events like somebody's trying to get on your network with the wrong password a whole bunch of times and then finally gets in, or a firewall gets flooded with authorization requests to shut it down. But the CyberShark solution can also see incidents, meaning that it not only sees that firewall attack and the failed authorization on another part of the network and data is being extracted out to IP ranges that were attached to part of the failed authentication. So he says, you know, we would look at that whole thing like from their sort of macro view, because they're monitoring all of this. They would say something like, you know, what we think's going on here is that the failed authorization is a distraction. First, they did a couple of password cracks, and then that was like a little subterfuge to go in the back door, and they're starting to take out data. So I just thought that that was so cool, and I think that this is this kind of technology is important for the mid-market, because historically, this is the kind of thing that large enterprises have the money and the manpower to do this sort of monitoring and whatnot. So now Black Stratus, which was in that space also, has created this more mid-market focused product to do exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of several things about Black Stratus that sort of stand out for me. So, yeah, first of all, they're... this CyberShark solution we're talking about is part of a relatively recent move on their part down market, essentially into the into the mid market, and so they have constructed and priced this accordingly. I think, and you're right, by the way, at a later point in this podcast, we're going to listen to a segment of an interview I did recently with a gentleman from Webroot. We're going to be talking about threat intelligence. And that conversation, this conversation we're having now, both sort of fit into this larger conversation in the security world, and I think we've touched on it on this podcast before, about what are loosely referred to as next-generation security products.
Mm-hmm.
So, traditional security products, like a firewall product, it's just going to kind of sit there like this big fence and try to keep bad guys out. And these next generation technologies do a whole bunch of different things, but a lot of them sort of fit into this general kind of threat intelligence kind of category, where there's some automated back-end machine learning smarts going on, analyzing all this stuff and sort of updating the security defenses in real or near real time based on what it's learning. And the thing that I'm not really qualified, what Black Stratus clearly identifies as a differentiator is their ability to correlate. So that's what's sort of interesting about that example they gave you, basically, is, anybody can see that these three different things happened to a network in close succession to one another, and they're, that's threat intelligence. If you act on those three different threats and sort of make sure that people are prepared to see those particular attacks and stop them, that's good stuff. But if you can somehow, if somehow your software is so smart that it sees those three different attacks against the network and can kind of correlate them, put them together, and tease out a strategy behind them. Oh, wait a minute, I see what they were doing.
Right.
Well, correlating is not considering it separate attacks, but as all part of the same attack, but just from an angle of distraction versus,
coordinated efforts, basically.
Thank you. Yeah. Can't talk today yet. A coordinated effort of distracting and touching over here on this network and over here while the real goal is over here, but they're trying to create a lot of noise elsewhere.
Right. And that's a higher order of thinking and analysis, basically. And they're, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure they have a lot of security experts on staff, but I'm sure it's not security experts who are looking at the event logs and figuring that stuff out. They, must have very sophisticated software that is able to kind of put these different incidents together and act on them in a much more complex kind of way.
Probably a good look at where that type of security product is moving to, because I have to imagine that as these attackers get more and more creative and more complex, they do more complex things to break in, to do nasty stuff, software has to catch up and start looking at these things more holistically and in this more smart way.
Yeah, I mean, that is the big sort of meta evolution in the security world right now, I think, is definitely the attackers are getting smarter and smarter, and it's very, very difficult even for the best, most cutting-edge security companies to keep up with them. But I think there's a pretty widespread recognition at this point that security software is going to have to evolve. It's going to have to get a lot smarter, basically, to keep companies safe at this point. That, traditional antivirus, firewall, et cetera, it's not like those things go away. More capable machine learning equipped kinds of solutions are really going to be a pretty essential part of anyone's defense strategy. Along with, I'll say, I mean, this is a little related but a little bit different, is there are also lots of these next-generation security technologies that provide sort of post-breach support. So there's also this strain of thought in the security world that says no matter how good our software gets, you're going to get breached sooner or later. It's like we can't protect anyone 100%. And so there are also these new technologies coming along that can, you know, identify that quickly and remediate, et cetera. But yeah, this is actually kind of an interest. I think from my, you know, amateur's view in the cheap seats, it's kind of an interesting moment in the security field because there's a very, very different kind of thinking about threat detection and mitigation that's showing up in some really interesting products like CyberShark.
Yeah, that's neat stuff. That's a good vendor to watch pick, Cecilia. I like that one.
Thanks.
Very cool. Speaking of things I like.
Oh, do we have to? I'm kidding.
Why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about something I like, which is a story we had up on the site that talks about HP doubling down on Windows Mobile. Interesting. All right, stick around for that. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. And so we had a story that that talks about HP making some big changes to what they're doing in the mobile market. And there's a couple things in this story that I found interesting. So one is that they are starting to phase out some of their Android tablet offerings and replacing those with Windows, which is kind of interesting. But also talking about pocket computing again, which is, you know, smaller form factor devices. And they're also they're using basically the word pocket computing to talk about phones. And as we've known for a while, and they've teased quite a bit, that in August they're coming out with a new Windows phone, or Windows Mobile phone, I guess is what they're calling it now. But it's running Windows Mobile 10, and it's got all of that Continuum stuff, and they're putting all the docks in place so you can dock it and use one device for all three purposes. As well as a lot of effort on the backside to make that docking experience much more robust, by allowing, you know, remote desktop type connection to a lot of popular apps, like Win32 system, big programs for like WinU Dock. So I think that's kind of cool. So the reason I wanted to talk about this is to talk about Windows Mobile a little bit. And Rich, you used Windows Phone for a long time, right?
Yes.
And I also am still, I mean, I review lots of things and I play with lots of stuff. I've got Android phones, I've got iPhones, but on as a day-to-day phone, I really like Windows Phone. I always have. I've been a big fan since I played with Windows Phone 7. I liked what they were doing. I thought it was different. I thought it was more concise. I think the experience is more integrated. And once you fall in love with Live Tiles, it's really hard to go back to like the whack-a-mole interface of other platforms. But as we all know, Windows Mobile is not taking off, and I wonder, I wonder if this is all of the strategy that Microsoft has. And kudos to HP for kind of diving in with them with this again, but HP doesn't necessarily have a great history of diving in with platforms and really sticking to it. So do you think, Rich, that this is going to be enough to save Windows Phone? Is this pure business approach that they're trying to go with?
Well, the verb you used there was save. you know, so I mean, do I think this kind of approach and these products that we're talking about here are going to be a giant breakthrough turnaround for Windows Phone? I don't, actually. So first of all, you know, in terms of the tablets, I mean, are those really, is it correct to think of those as running Windows Mobile, or aren't those really sort of like Windows, you know, almost pure Windows 10 devices?
Well, it doesn't say specifically. So I can say this, is that any device that's over 9 inches, but based on the latest documentation from Microsoft, is that any device over 9 inches has to be Windows, a full Windows x86 experience. Anything under 9 inches can be Windows Mobile or Windows 10. You know, you can kind of go or Windows Mobile or full Windows. So it wasn't exactly clear in what HP was saying here, but I think they're going to start phasing out some of their smaller business devices. So it said, you know, they had 8 different devices, detachables and verticals and stuff. And I think they're recognizing that the standalone tablet market is shrinking, and it's the 12 to 14 inch factor that's kind of taking off, you know, basically like your Surface clones. So at that size, Android, I think, makes less sense. I think when you're at that size, people want a full Windows computer experience with, you know, all of the programs and apps and versatility that it offers. And I think they're just going to be phasing out some of the smaller ones.
Yeah, I mean, that piece of the strategy, of the HP strategy, you know, made perfect sense to me when I was reading this article earlier. We've spoken a number of times on the podcast about how hot the 2-in-1 market, for example, is right now. And like you said, 12 inches and up with the 2-in-1s and so on. And, you know, does it really make sense? Those are essentially laptops. Maybe they have a detachable keyboard or a display you can flip around or whatever. But, I mean, really, they're laptops. And everybody is quite comfortable running a laptop with Windows and, you know, to an increasing degree, Windows 10. So does it really make sense for HP to be supporting this second platform, given that standalone tablets are less popular and Android is a hugely popular, smartphone and consumer platform, but not really a business, and certainly not a business laptop kind of platform. So it just felt like, yeah, it's kind of a sensible thing for them to do. That the wild card in this article, the interesting thing was just the discussion about the Elite X3, which is the smartphone that takes full advantage of the Windows Continuum functionality so that you can use it as a phone or as a, you know, like a little tiny laptop. You know, you can plug it into a keyboard and a monitor, and so I guess that's not really a laptop. That's like a little desktop. It's a phone 1 minute, and then when you dock it, it becomes a desktop as well.
Basically with the right peripherals, it can be, it's a 3-in-1 device. It can be anything. It could be a laptop if you plug it into a very small screen with a detachable keyboard, or if you flip it on its side and hook it up with a Bluetooth keyboard and pointing device, it's still basically a small laptop.
Go ahead. The thing that I'm curious about is with all of these different kinds of devices, you know, 2-in-1s and whatever, how much would the Elite X3 cost? I mean, the price hasn't been published yet, but for something like that, like, where do you think that price point would be?
My guess is going to be $999. I think it's going to be $1,000 with a dock.
Okay.
But if you look at it from a business perspective, because what they're also saying is that this is not going to be something that is available through the consumer channel, with one exception, is that Microsoft might sell it inside the Windows Store as a hero device, which is basically just my innermost frustration with how the transition and the life of Windows Phone / Windows Mobile has gone over the last several years. Is like, let's make some cool devices, and then let's just make sure that nobody can ever buy them. Let's partner with let's not have a phone on Verizon for 2 years. Let's put it in AT&T and let them not sell it. You know, I got a whole big piece that I've been working on for like weeks on and off, because I've been really trying to narrow this down, and I have come to the conclusion that as awesome as Nokia was for Windows Phone, I actually think it was Nokia that actually ended up killing Windows Phone. Interesting argument, eh, Rich?
Oof. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to anticipate where you're going with that, basically. But is it because it created this sort of conflict inside the four walls of Microsoft about, you know, are we selling a platform? Are we selling a hardware?
No, not the purchase of Nokia. Microsoft had no choice to do that. The reason why I'm kind of blaming in my own head Nokia for killing Windows Phone is because Nokia went, they decided to go all in on that platform, and boy did they ever. They took, which was at the time, I mean, they were a failing kind of company at the time, but they were still a huge juggernaut in design and hardware, and they took Windows Phone and they ran with it. Phones like the 920 and the 1020 and the Icon, all of the apps and stuff that they built around that ecosystem, what Nokia ended up doing was making it so that way no other company could possibly compete with them. And that proved out in numbers over time. I mean, basically, if you were going to buy a Windows phone, you were going to buy a Nokia phone because Samsung and LG and all of the other partners that were kind of dabbling in that ecosystem at the time, they just were never going to keep up because they were never going to put the amount of investment that Nokia put into it. So by the time Nokia really ended up sinking, Microsoft had no choice but to buy them. Right? Because they were 98% of the Windows Phone market, and they can't let 98% of the market just die. So they had to buy that segment out. And of course, like what Microsoft does a lot of the times when they buy companies, is they just fail to execute and just let it die. Since Nokia put out, and they put out too many crap phones, we all know that, they never came up with a proper successor to the 920, which was a very popular phone at the time. They never came up with even though the 1020 wasn't a... But 1020 is the one with that mega massive camera on it. Even though that wasn't a huge seller, it was still a showpiece and an icon, and it got people talking, and it gave them the ability to put out commercials that showed something different. And then Microsoft bought them. It took another year-ish, year and a half, to get the 950 and the 950 XL, which is only on AT&T, or like only the 950 is on AT&T. The rest are all unlocked, and you buy them in the Microsoft store. They're like $600. You can't get anything on Verizon. You can't. I mean, the AT&T is the only wireless provider you could walk in and buy a Windows phone. I mean, like, how can you make a phone ecosystem successful if you don't make the product available to buy?
Well, so I guess my question would be, how much of that is Microsoft's fault, and how much of that is the fault, and maybe fault's the wrong word. I don't know if you can blame these guys, but how much of the blame goes to Microsoft versus Verizon or AT&T? So I'm a longtime Verizon guy, and the reason I recently switched from a Windows phone to iPhone is because, as you say, Verizon just hasn't. I mean, they never even officially went to I mean, I'm trying to remember if they went to a Windows Phone 7.5, let alone 8. I mean,
they had Windows Phone 8 devices. But, I mean, Verizon's support of Windows Phone was god-awful. I mean, I blame Verizon just as much as Microsoft, right? But if you're trying to compete and you're trying to sell a platform, get your frickin' phone on the platform. You know, get your phone in there, right? Do something to get it in there. I don't care what it is. Do something.
Do we know they haven't been trying hard to do exactly that and encountering a stone wall of resistance, basically? It's like, you guys have 3% market share. I'm putting you see these two guys over here, Ernie and Ted? They're your Windows Phone team, and get as much done with them as you can, because the rest of us are focused on the stuff that's really selling. And you can yell and scream and you know, pound the table and tell them, no, we really need to partner and be more serious about selling this stuff. But if Verizon doesn't see opportunity in that, what more can Microsoft do?
Give them money.
Well, there's always that.
They have lots of money.
They do.
The thing is that when you're building, I mean, okay, Windows Mobile has been a giant flop in many ways for Microsoft, and I blame Nokia for some of that. I also blame this constant reset cycle that they had between Windows Phone 7 and then a complete reset to Windows Phone 8, complete reset to Windows Phone 10 or Windows Mobile. And it's like, if they would stop like reinventing the wheel and just iterate, kind of like what they're doing now with Windows 10, I would think it might have been a little bit of an easier sell for people. There's the whole app gap thing, but clearly Microsoft was never pushing it as much as they could, right? When you're only on one of the cell phone providers in the United States, I mean, like, that's not pushing it hard, that you're not there. You're not making enough noise. It was better for a long time. You got to make a better product. I don't want to drag on about this. Maybe we can have a big, longer discussion of the death of Windows Phone another time. But my concern is that HP's got this Elite X3. So let's get back to where we were talking. The Elite X3 is a business-focused device. So, like, Microsoft seems to be saying, okay, Windows Mobile, we're going to focus on business now. How is that going to work, right? I mean, that if you're not selling your, like, how many people actually carry dedicated phones from their business, or, you know, for business now? Isn't BYOD, like, your phone, isn't, like, don't you always bring your own phone to work now? Isn't that, like, what you do 99% of the time?
No.
And, in fact, there's a bit of a swing. I wouldn't want to quantify it exactly, but there's a swing away from BYOD to CYOD these days.
Yep.
Choose your own device.
Even in phones, though?
I don't know, but I assume so.
So is there a case where you're still going to hear this complaint about the app gap with Windows Mobile and the Windows Store. So how is it possible that selling some small amount of business-focused devices through the channel will ever help make the developer argument to support Windows Mobile? Right? Don't you need that consumer presence? I mean, iPhone and Android both have a giant consumer presence to build that developer base, and then there are business devices, I'm sure, that kind of come out of that. Windows might be might have a better argument in business, but I fear that without that consumer side, without those phones, you know, getting attention in Verizon stores and AT&T stores and Sprint stores and being used by a much broader base of the public, how is that going to happen?
Well, I mean, I wonder if anyone is even trying to make that happen anymore at this point. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about the Elite X3, it's as if basically, rather than try to make this to turn Windows Mobile into a hit product and capitalize on that, what they essentially did is take advantage of this continuum functionality in Windows 10 to invent a new form factor, essentially. So, I mean, it's a phone, but it's a phone that's also, you know, like you said, it's a 3-in-1. And the target is squarely going to be corporate IT hardware buyers. You can imagine there being, there being companies out there that will think, okay, for this segment of my user base, this might actually be a really smart, you know, choice. Instead of giving those guys Surface Pro 4s or laptops or whatever, because of the nature of the work that they do and their robust travel schedule or whatever, I'm going to give them one of these Elite X3s, and that's going to be their sort of, you know, core corporate-provided work device. So it's not going to change the Windows Mobile story in any huge way. It's not going to make billions and billions of dollars for HP, but it could be, you know, a product that gets some traction in IT departments and businesses.
So will the Elite X3 have legs if it is deployed as the only business tool an employee is given? Possibly. It still depresses me that there is basically no more consumer argument for Windows devices, for Windows phone-like devices. And that makes me sad.
Yeah, well, and like you said, we can have a big long discussion about that on a few, because that's absolutely where we're at right now. Microsoft under Nadella has given up entirely on the consumer market, and there were a lot of missteps and mistakes and lost opportunities that sort of led up to that. And I think I've spoken, I don't know if I've spoken on the podcast or just with you guys before, but I mean, shortly before he left the company, I had an opportunity to hear Steve Ballmer speak. This is when he was still CEO, and I mean, you know, he wasn't explicitly addressing this topic, But if you were to kind of listen to this answer that he gave to some big corporate CIO at a at an internal event, I mean, essentially what he was saying is you go all the way back to Windows Vista. It was like, you know, from the Windows Vista development point forward, they were basically doomed in mobile. It's over, I think, for now, at least, for Windows Mobile in consumer. And I think Nadella's strategy basically is to stop fighting the battle he knows he's lost and try to initiate a battle that he can win in a totally new market, maybe, you know, that Microsoft can dominate as it's dominated other markets before. And I have no idea what that would be, but I've heard him say things that suggest to me that's kind of what he's thinking. It's like, okay, let's stop trying to turn 3% market share into 6 and build from there. Let's think about something new where the playing field is level and we can be the first mover instead of trying to catch up.
You know what drives me nuts is that 3% market share, which Windows Phone was a little over 3% in the United States for a while. That's more than 10 million users. And, you know, Apple has had a successful Mac business with 10 million users for 20 years. A successful, profitable business. What drives me crazy is that Microsoft gets 10 million users, and it's like, oh, and they look at it as some paltry percentage, but really it's a lot of people. 10 million. That's
yeah.
A lot of phones. That's a lot of support. That's a base to grow from. And it just it's a shame no one ever saw it that way. They just saw it as some small niche. But you know, when Apple has a niche, it's super successful and it's profitable and it's whatever. And anybody else has some niche market, it's doom. It's not enough. You know, you're getting creamed. Windows Phone, Windows Mobile fans, I want to hear from you. Are we crazy? Do we want more Windows Phone? Do you think the Elite X3 is going to be a big hit? Would you see yourself, selling this thing or deploying this out? Do you see yourself personally wanting to use one? Send me an email, podcast@channelpronetwork.com, and let's get some conversation going about Windows Mobile and the Elite X3. Tell us what you think. So, Rich, CompTIA has some foresight, it looks like.
Some foresight, you say? Well,
What do they see?
I can tell you about some things they have seen, because they not too long ago went out and did some polling of managed service providers, and just this week they published a new research study, their fifth annual Trends in Managed Services report, which is interesting actually, because they've been doing a research study about managed services every year for a bunch of years, 5 years. But the last few reports actually were polls of end users about managed services. It's been, I think 2012 was the last time they actually went out and polled MSPs. So kind of a fresh look at what MSPs are thinking these days. And we have an article up on the website about that. I thought there were some interesting kind of nuggets there, because basically, both in managed services and in cloud computing, it was sort of a mix of good news, bad news. You know, it's like the MSPs say that they're bullish on revenue. Basically, we're making more money on the top line, but keeping less money on the bottom line. They're all worried about margin erosion, and in cloud computing, there were some statistics in there about, you know, you can clearly see that even the most determined sort of cloud skeptics have capitulated. And, you know, I mean, let's see if I can find that number. 54% of surveyed MSPs said cloud solutions is a strategic part of their business. Only 3% of the MSPs surveyed aren't offering anything in the cloud right now. It's like everybody knows you've got to be in the cloud. But at the same time, the study revealed that 44% of MSPs sell cloud services to their clients only when the clients ask for them, basically. So everybody's
business model.
That was pretty interesting.
Model.
That's probably the single most interesting statistic in this survey here was this,
yeah.
I don't like the cloud. I'm going to sell the cloud, but I'm only going to do it if they make me do it.
I mean, there's no strategy involved or anything. I mean, it's just, it's like seat of the pants IT provider.
Right, and you have to kind of think about where the market's going here next, and what is or isn't going to make you relevant to your customers. And,
right.
It's great to be able to meet that need when that need is sort of handed to you. That's important. But I would think it's a smarter long-term strategy to,
It's good to have a plan. It's very good to have a plan.
Yeah.
Well, that's an easy way to start a sales pitch, though. Hey, customer, is there anything you want to buy?
I was thinking about some cloud solutions myself.
The cloud, you say, huh? You want some fries with that cloud?
Supersize them.
Yeah, you think you might want to get a little more excited about what you're selling and actually, sell it.
And be able to kind of guide that conversation a little bit, too, So many experts talk about cloud orchestration as a value-added service that, let's face it, a lot of these cloud services that MSPs and others are reselling don't pay enormous margins. But there are ways to kind of preserve your margin, basically, and being a cloud expert / orchestrator is one of them, being able to kind of come in and understand the business needs and put together a package of solutions that is custom tailored to this particular customer. That is a business model that could work.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, maybe that's happening. Maybe we're just we're just looking at this the wrong way, but I don't know. Seemed kind of sketchy to me.
At a minimum, there are too many MSPs who are being too passive about the cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, and it would be interesting to know out of what are the demographics of those three different statistics, the 54%, the 3%, and the 43%, or no, 44%, whatever it was. I'd be interested to know, how old, how many years in business, that kind of thing.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, it would be very interesting to see breakouts. Maybe one of these days, because I got an opportunity to interview Carol and April from CompTIA about the study before writing that article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe one of these days we'll have her on the podcast or something, and we can kind of pick her brain about some of that stuff.
Yeah, definitely, because it would make sense that if there are solution providers who are offering cloud services when customers ask for it, maybe they've got an established business. Maybe for some of them it's more of like a lifestyle business. Maybe they're not really looking to, grow. Maybe they're kind of at the end of the road and thinking about selling the business or retiring or whatever. So that's why I was wondering. Because there are good reasons not to get into a new model, depending on where you are in your continuum.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I sometimes refer to that phenomenon you're talking about as running out the clock. I do think there are a fair number of channel pros out there who know that they're going to be getting out within the next few years, and they've just got their fingers crossed that they don't need, they can continue to run a reasonably profitable business without having to totally change into this new model and sell and retire.
I'm just upset that I didn't put this story before the whole Windows Mobile talk, because when you said the word continuum, man, that would have been a good segue. Oh, missed opportunity.
Yeah.
I tell ya. Hey, speaking of threat intelligence from earlier, you got a chance to talk with Webroot on that topic, right?
Just last week, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I was at... the ConnectWise LabTech Automation Nation event last week, and while I was there, I got an opportunity to sit down with Charlie Tomeo. I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He is their Vice President of Worldwide Channel and Technical Sales over at Webroot. You know, Webroot's a pretty well-known name in the channel, big security vendor, and they've had a threat intelligence product since, I think, about 2014. And so what we're going to listen to here, I believe, is an excerpt from that conversation I had with Charlie last week, in which we talked about threat intelligence generally, and we talked about their product specifically, and the role of threat intelligence in securing SMBs. The conversation actually began, though, as you're about to hear, with a quick discussion of the changing SMB security threat landscape, specifically and especially in light of the rise of ransomware attacks like CryptoLocker.
Are attackers specifically targeting SMBs now, or are SMBs kind of getting swept up in things like CryptoLocker just because there are a lot of them?
I think that they... I think that they're an easier target because they don't have the ability to have all the same tools that an enterprise would. So the enterprise has a different defense in depth approach where they have a lot of different tools at the network layer that are able to protect against that. And so they're not able to get hit by those as easy as, let's say, you know, a doctor's office or a dentist's office where they may just have the endpoint protection as their only, you know, it's basically their only way to protect the endpoints and their data.
So from Webroot's perspective, threat intelligence is sort of a necessary complement to that traditional endpoint security?
Absolutely. And I think that's the big thing is, you know, and we're seeing that as part of, you know, really being more of a next generation endpoint protection, is that needs to be something that's already in the product.
And how does threat intelligence sort of factor into the security tool set? I mean, how does it... make endpoint security more effective or provide a different kind of protection on its own?
So it's really targeting and trying to cut down those 0 days, right? Closing that window of vulnerability that they have out there. So that's one of the, you know, the biggest challenges that we've seen, you know, in the past where, you know, we see some threats that are out there for months and in some cases years. You know, these are things that are very much one-off. So, you know, being able to have as close to real-time data when it comes to threats is really an important thing.
How much awareness of threat intelligence is there in the SMB channel right now?
I still think it's early days right now. So we're not seeing, you know, we're starting to see more MSPs doing, you know, or getting involved with this, but those are the ones that have already adopted maybe... having a defense in-depth approach for their customers, so they have, you know, they have something at the network as well as something at the endpoint. But it definitely is something that, you know, we're still working on to educate.
And is the issue truly just awareness and sort of understanding that this kind of offering is out there, or are you kind of working to help them get it, basically, they understand the importance?
It's definitely a bit of both. You know, so I think that... depending on who you talk to, I still think that, you know, a lot of people look at it and view it as, you know, they understand it's a necessary evil, but they haven't gotten past that, you know, it's not just like a traditional antivirus plate that's gonna solve the solution. So, you know, if you see what, you know, some of our customers have seen is as they've moved to us, they've been able to basically save headcount. You know, a lot of these MSPs have had headcount in the past where they just focused on remediation, you know, actually, you know, taking files from backup, recovering those, things like that. So they already have tools in place to say if they get hit, here's what we're going to go through. Here's how we're going to help the customer. So we've actually seen some of our customers actually remove that space, save that headcount, and they're able to quantify, you know, a dollar savings based on that.
So let's dive into that a little bit. I mean, the MSP opportunity around threat intelligence, so some of that, it efficiency and cost savings, is there an incremental revenue opportunity to adding this as well?
I think for some of their customers there is. You know, in other cases, they're not going to be able to make money on it, but to be able to save money in some of their you know, hard costs, like, you know, just putting bodies on it, you know, taking, you know, some of their support engineers that work on this stuff all day, you know, winds up being a savings for them. And also gives them the ability to focus on what hopefully you want to do as a business is growing and adding more customers. So, you know, if they could add more and more customers based on their reputation, but also based on the fact that they're leveraging their resources in a different manner as opposed to, you know, constantly just sitting there doing remediation, you know, I think that we've seen a lot of our partners that do that will grow quickly.
Do they or can they use it almost as a marketing tool as well, you know, to talk to a sales prospect?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because we've seen some of our, you know, MSPs that we know are looking to really grow and expand are using that as part of their pitch when they're talking to their customers. So they're showing, you know, not the customer's information, but the data of, you know, kind of this is what things look like. You know, this is how many hours that we've saved. You know, we don't have as many tickets that we're addressing, you know, every quarter, every month. You know, I had one of my partners say that they had, you know, one of our competitors' product when they moved over, before they moved over to us, they were dealing with 4 to 5 ransomware issues a day, and they were down to about 1 or 2 every couple of months when they moved over to us. So it's significant. You know, when they looked at that, they said, it's significant for us, but it's also significant for the customers. So they were actually using that as a selling point as to why you'd go with them.
And that gets you, you know, through the door and allows you to establish a relationship with a customer. But, you know, just listening to that, those statistics, I would think customer retention is another benefit of using something like threat intelligence because it's just fewer customers getting.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, yeah. And I think that's it. You know, that's the thing for them is they want, you know. You know, the one thing about the space is that everyone talks to everyone. So, you know, for us, you know, that's been kind of the best marketing is, you know, just having somebody that's really passionate about the product go and then talking to other people within other groups. And, you know, we've seen, you know, some really nice steady growth from that.
Now, WebRoot obviously isn't the only vendor with a threat intelligence offering. So, I mean, what are some of your top differentiators?
Yeah, I think you know, most of it is you know, the fact of how we do things. You know, we're cloud-based company, so it gives us the ability to have some real-time you know, protection and detection. We also look at things a little bit differently on the endpoint side, where we categorize everything as good, bad, and unknown. So traditionally, if you look at what people did in a threat intelligence on an endpoints is they provided their customers with, here's a list of known bads. And as long as you were on that list, they were going to do a great job. And, you know, right now, I think the good and the bad, you know, that's not what keeps everybody up at night. It's the unknown that keeps everybody up. So we actually will monitor everything that's going on with that unknown when it's running on a system, while it's in an unknown state. As soon as it's determined that it's good or bad, then we'll take the appropriate action. If it's good, we no longer need to monitor it. If it's bad, we then take it and we actually will roll back any changes that it's made. So that's a, you know, kind of a unique feature it does. We have a feature called journaling and rollback. So as it's in that unknown state, we actually will monitor everything that it's doing. And then it gives us the ability to then roll that back at a later date.
All right, and that was Charlie Tomeo of WebRoot. Rich, what's your takeaways from that conversation?
Well, first, not to avoid the question, I should toss in, so what you just heard was about half of the actual total conversation I had with Charlie. There were a few little news nuggets in the second half of that conversation that I figured I'd mention here, too. So first off, at one point in the discussion, he said that WebRoot has added over 6,000 MSPs to its channel in the last couple of years, which I thought was kind of a big number, kind of impressive. I asked him at one point in our conversation about the Symantec Bluecoat deal, which was a very big deal in the IT world when it happened just very recently. I mean, maybe not a huge surprise. He basically said, you know, we view that as an opportunity rather than a threat for those companies to be getting together because there's usually a lot of disruption, or at least there's a potential for disruption when companies merge like that. And so, you know, there may be some dissatisfied customers we can grab. And then, you know, maybe the most newsworthy little thing I got out of him, I was asking him about the Internet of Things and what Webroot thinks about the Internet of Things. And he basically said, you know, we're thinking very actively about Internet of Things, and without being terribly specific about it, he did say that they were going to have an Internet of Things specific solution on the market at some point within the next year. So that'll be interesting to see what that turns out to be.
Protecting those doodads.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, lots of doodads to secure. In terms of what we did here just now on the podcast, I thought it was interesting. When I was talking with him, I was a little bit surprised by his positioning threat intelligence really as a way for MSPs to save money as opposed to make money. You know,
yeah.
A way to be more efficient about how you're protecting customers and reduce overhead. That wasn't what I anticipated hearing.
No, and I was actually going to ask you, because that kind of was my take. He was talking about, I don't remember exactly, personnel or whatever, and it's like, wait a second, is he kind of advocating, so because you're not scrambling around with all of your techs trying to kind of clean up after, you know, ransomware or whatever, wrong word, but because the threat intelligence would give you more insight into what was going on, and here's, he talked about like good, bad, and unknown. So they find something unknown, they're watching it, they determine that it's bad, and, you know, crisis avoided, that you don't need that manpower. So that really was what he was saying, is that you'll save money on headcount. Yes?
Yeah. No, I mean, that was the point. And he wasn't, you know, saying, hey, this is great, you're going to be able to lay off a bunch of people. But I mean,
yeah. No.
But you'll be able to utilize your tech headcount in other ways. You won't need to, devote as much time to fighting fires, because we're going to help you prevent the fires from breaking out.
Right. I did like that he was talking about threat intelligence as being a differentiator, because while Webroot is not the only player in that space, I do think that it's pretty novel kind of a thing. It's, you know, it's one of those newer security, a newer generation security, whatever. And can't talk today either, Matt. I must have caught it from you.
<It's>
I talked
contagious.
To you too much.
And you know, the funny thing is, of the three of us, I'm the decaf drinker.
I know. I'm like super hopped up on caffeine. And
No, I'm a decaf drinker too.
Oh, okay.
I'm just brain dead. So I thought it was interesting that he said, you know, this could be a good differentiator for an IT provider. And I agree with that. And I think that solution providers need to look at some of these solutions and see, you know, kind of looking at what their clients need, but also what would be good for their business. You know, exactly what our Reader's Choice Awards are about, looking at solutions that not only, you know, provide great business value to clients, but that also provide value to your own business.
And following up quickly on your differentiation point there too, like I mentioned before, they, you know, I believe Webroot introduced its threat intelligence service in 2014. And again, not a security market expert necessarily, but I think that kind of was relatively early to be having a threat intelligence offering. So you would assume that from a differentiation standpoint for them, that, you know, their platform might be a little bit more mature than some of the other ones that are out there. And, I mean, there are definitely a lot of other ones out there, but that is not nearly as crowded a market as other segments of security right now.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, on that note, why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we're going to hit our end of the show regular features, as well as our poll result from last week. You mentioned Internet of Things with Webroot, that's kind of what our poll was about last week. So why don't we just take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about all that stuff and maybe more. Maybe. We'll be right
back.
All right, and we are back. And Rich, Cecilia, last week, while we were yapping about Internet of Things, we did a poll. And we weren't quite sure what the poll question was going to be, but we came up with it finally. And the poll question was, are you enthusiastic or skeptical about offering Internet of Things solutions? So I ended up giving four possible answers. Enthusiastic, indifferent, skeptical, and what? Internet of Things? That's like supposed to be for people who don't know what that is.
Thank you for clarifying.
So right now, the poll results are split only between two answers. Apparently no one is indifferent and everybody knows what it is currently. So, but right now, skeptical is leading the charge at 57% of the vote, and enthusiastic at 43% of the vote.
Wow.
Yeah. So. Yeah, a surprising degree of enthusiasm, at least surprising me.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll leave this poll up a little longer. Maybe we'll check in on the results next week and see if we get some more votes on it. Maybe, Cecilia, you could drop this a link to this poll in our newsletter tomorrow.
Okay. That would be awesome.
Yeah, well, I'll give you the direct link to send people to the newsletter page, or the poll page. But yeah, I'm actually excited that more people seem to be more enthusiastic than skeptical. I think IoT is cool, and I think as we get more concrete examples of it and more opportunities start to make sense and people kind of get the idea of what it can do, I think more people will get enthusiastic over time, and maybe that's starting to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, cool. I completely agree.
Pretty cool stuff. All right. As everyone knows, we tend to follow our globe-trotting associate publisher, Mr. Joel Zaidspanner, around. I pronounce it differently every time, I swear.
It's really easy.
Joel Z.
Zaidspanner.
That's it too.
Spinner.
Joel. But you'd think there'd be two N's in his name, but it's.
No, it's Spinner with one N.
It's Spin, but it doesn't. Joel Z around the industry as he hops from event to event. He's all over the place. He's at shows. He's at conferences. He's visiting customers. He's on vacation. Wherever he is, he's generally not home, except for when I say that, and then it's going to be boring, and he's going to be at home.
He's home.
Is he home this week?
Yes.
Figures.
And since we're going to do a podcast again next week, I'll just tell everyone in advance he's going to be home next week, too.
Okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Because last time I saw him... was I think 2 weeks ago at a Tech Data event. And at that time, he was talking to me about this big long trip he was going to go on, visiting potential sites for our 2017 forum events and vendor visits. It sounded like he was going to be, you know, there weren't any conferences to attend, but he was actually going to be out on the road here and about. But wow, 2 weeks at home for Joel. That's
I don't know if that's right. I thought he was going to be out scoping hotels and stuff for events. That was what my little birdie told me. So ladies and gentlemen, this week he is in Florida, according to Miss Cecilia, but who knows? Maybe he'll go somewhere else next week. You never know. You never know where he's going to be.
Send us your Joel sightings, people.
Yeah. You know what? Sometimes I think that would help if we had sightings.
Yes, it would be really funny if even people in his hometown were like phoning in and saying, "Oh, he's at the Dunkin' Donuts."
Well, sometimes like we don't know where he is, and it would be helpful if people would kind of help us keep tabs on him.
Yeah.
Because he's a very secretive guy moving around. That or we got to get a contact up there at Delta that we can always call, who can like eavesdrop on his flight reservations. So that's Mr. Joel this week. My museum pick. Should I do a museum pick this week? Yeah. Let's do a museum pick. I'm answering my own questions now. You guys were supposed to say, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Matt.
Absolutely.
Museum pick. All right. In honor of HP and their diving into Windows Mobile, I decided to reach into my collection and pick out a gem of the past from when also HP was diving into Windows Mobile, and that is with their iPac line of pocket PCs. I happen to have a one of the more recent generation. I mean, recent as in like 2000, you know, three or some or so, but you know, long time ago. But it, one of the newer ones before these things started to really get phased out for phones. But it's the HP iPac HX2495. So if you go to the website channelpronetwork.com and hit our Matt's weekly museum pick gallery. I'll put one or more pictures of this thing in there with hopefully some different screens. But this was a marvel of pocket computing at the time, running Windows Mobile 5.0 for Pocket PC Premium Edition, powered by an Intel PXA 270 processor running at 520 megahertz. A high-resolution 240 by 320 pixel. Okay, so half VGA quality, 3.5-inch screen, TFT color matrix, or TFT LCD display, 16-bit color, 256 megabytes of total memory, 192 megabytes user-available persistent storage, 64 megabytes of RAM, 192 megabyte ROM for the OS. Was complete with infrared, Bluetooth, 802.11b wireless LAN, had a stereo headphone jack, mic. Not that you'd really use it as a phone, but you could do like recording and stuff with it. Had a stylus, had a stylus, so it was the touch version of Pocket PC, which is like really the only good version of Pocket PC, not those crap wheel non-touch phones that came out later. And compact flash and SD. So, Rich, you played around with Pocket PCs back in the day, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I did not have I didn't have this product. I didn't have any iPac device when as late in the game as when they had the HP branding on them. But I did have a couple of different compact iPac devices. One of which was very similar to this. Had the color display, et cetera.
And so I used Windows Mobile for a very long time. What was your opinion of it?
Of my color compact iPac.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was a great device. It was a handy thing to have. Now, I mean, as soon as the first Microsoft smartphone came out, I'm not talking like post iPhone. I'm talking about those you remember those very first Microsoft smartphones that came out like 2002 or 3 or whatever.
Yep.
Once you add phone functionality into the picture, basically these devices became a little bit less useful. But in its day, it was a handy thing to have in your pocket.
Yeah, imagine before all of that smartphone stuff, this thing could browse the internet with a web browser. It didn't have, because it wasn't persistently online, you would use sync functionality with Outlook to get the most out of the whole email and calendaring functions of it. So there was usually they came with like a little dock, you'd plug it into your PC and you'd install the ActiveSync client. So you would put it on the dock and then it would sync up all your mail and calendar appointments that you did on your computer and put it on there. And if you did anything on the iPac, it would sync that over to your desktop the next time you're out there. It was expandable with different programs. It could record voice. It managed contacts. It could play games. It could do a lot.
Wash
I used mine.
Dishes.
It did not do your dishes, unfortunately. But I used this particular product quite a bit for a long time. I kind of went through the normal transition. We all saw my Sharp organizer, which was well before a device like this. And I used a Palm Pilot for a while, and then ultimately went to this, and just loved the integration with Outlook and that kind of thing. So this was a great product, and certainly a blast from the past, and it shows that HP has a history with Windows Mobile. They made a lot of great products, arguably not a huge take, these didn't take off to any huge degree, but a lot of people in business had them. So who knows? Maybe there is something behind this whole X3 thing. Who knows? Cecilia, did you have an iPack?
I didn't have an iPack.
No? No,
but I did have a Palm for a little while.
You had a Palm? So you kind of used one of these. I don't know if I brought out any of my Palm Pilots. I actually have like 6 Palm Pilots in my museum. Oof. And I do have another Windows mobile device that I'll bust out another day, perhaps. But that one's a phone device, so we'll do that one another time. But yeah, cool. So anyway, that's the museum pick this week. Go and look at some pictures. I'll put some little interesting trivia bits on it over there. So moving on to my hardware pick. My hardware pick this week is one that kind of came out of personal necessity. So recently I kind of redid my living room, and I used to do home theater, high-end home theater stuff a very long time ago. So I'm kind of nuts with the whole surround sound, you know, kind of thing. I got a pretty rockin' surround system and with that a receiver that weighs like 80 pounds. And I always have a hard time like trying to stack this stuff up. So ultimately I decided to stop bother to try to find a audio tower that would work for this that looked nice. I just ended up putting an IT rack in my living room. So trust me, when I was putting it together, I was looking at my wife and I was saying, "Hun, do you remember when you were a little girl and you were thinking about your future dream home?" Now, I know at the time she was dreaming that one day she would have a 2-post Enterprise IT rack
in her living room. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
But actually, it looks really good in there, I have to say. And that the shelves on that thing, you know, hold the receiver with plenty of room to spare. But wiring this thing, because there's no back to this, the wiring is kind of a problem. And there's like side things you can get for wiring, but I don't have one of those, and my wife won't let me put one on, so I have to keep all the wires behind it. But I was looking for a way to organize it. So my pick this week was a way that you can attach some wire management to a rack, and I found a really nice one from StarTech.com, and it is the StarTech.com 1U 19-inch horizontal cable management panel. So if you have some space, you know, at least 1U of space, you know, in your rack, you can get this like panel that kind of goes across. It gives you some guides to, you know, have like finger ducts and horizontal and vertical D-ring hooks for wires. It's very cost effective. It looks nice. I have one on order. I haven't gotten it yet, but it looks like it'll do a fine job of keeping some wires in place. And since you can kind of twist the little D-rings around, you can go back and forth. They also make a 2U model if you have like some big wires or you want to do like a bigger channel between them. But I'm thinking one of these would be enough to kind of get my wires kind of centralized and not flying out the side. But you know, if you need one or two of these, you could kind of put them in different spots of the rack to keep your wires nice and straight. So I thought if you're doing some wiring and you've always had a desire to get some wire management that isn't a side piece, but to get a dedicated wire management piece that can go on the post across and help you do wires up and down, check this one out. I think you will like it. So that is my tech pick, the StarTech.com 1U 19-inch horizontal cable management panel.
Good pick.
Yeah, I know you got many of those, right, Cecilia?
All
of your IT racks have at home?
Let me put it this way. I should, but I don't.
But you like tidy, scalable server workspaces, don't you?
Yes. I live for tidy server workspaces.
Don't we all? Well, I mean, trust me, remember those pictures that we looked in that one gallery several weeks ago, like wiring nightmares?
Yes.
Those people needed this particular management panel to make their wires look pretty.
Yeah. They needed ones much larger, though.
Yes. Much, much larger. Rich, why don't you give us the look at what has been and the preview of what is to come?
I would be happy to do that for you. So in my In Case You Missed It piece, which runs every Friday on channelpronetwork.com, we're going to be taking a look at a little news worth knowing out of the big Red Hat Summit partner event that happened this week, which is not a huge, huge deal, I think, probably for a lot of our listeners here, but there were some interesting announcements that came out of that, specifically with respect to container technology, which is kind of an interesting area. I also have a little reminder about a change happening today, actually, to the Office 365 suite that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention. And then take a peek at something that ought to be interesting to you, Matt, and maybe you already know about it, given your tech museum, which is the, to me at least, surprisingly robust market out there for vintage computer hardware, and some of the crazy sums people are paying for very, very old items. In What's Up This Week, which runs every Monday on the Channel Pro site and takes a look at the week ahead, we will be looking at not very much, actually, because this coming week, this is going to be one of the quietest weeks in the industry of the year, partly because it's shortened by the holiday and partly because the week after next is Microsoft's Worldwide Partner Conference. And I can't name names, but I can tell you for a fact that there are a lot of vendors out there with product announcements that they're going to be making at the Worldwide Partner Conference. So I think there are a lot of people kind of hanging on to the good stuff for 2 weeks from now. Therefore, there isn't a whole ton going on next week. But on Friday, next Friday is actor Kevin Bacon's birthday, and so I figured maybe we could play a little 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, but just use Bill Gates or somebody like that instead.
Well, you never know what pops up in a given week. Maybe if it is slow, maybe we'll try to get some fun stuff out on the site. Maybe a gallery or two. I've been wanting to do a piece on top overused buzzwords in the channel for a long time. Maybe it's time we actually roll that one out, and we'll do that next week or something.
That could be fun.
Yeah, I also want to say that we're talking a lot about our WPC. We're going to have a lot of special coverage here at Channel Pro on the Worldwide Partner Conference. We're hoping to blow that out, so stay tuned next week for some looks ahead at what we're going to be doing for the Worldwide Partner Conference, including possibly a few special edition, shorter, but special edition WPC podcasts. At least one. I think we're going to try to do at least one, right, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah. If not a daily, maybe we can do a daily. Just kind of hit the news real quick. So lots to look forward to, and you're going to miss it if you haven't subscribed to Channel Pro Weekly. Now, when I say subscribe, that doesn't mean give me money. That just means go to iTunes, search Channel Pro Weekly in iTunes, or follow follow the link on our website. And it will take you there. So subscribe there, just so that way every week when a new Channel Pro Weekly podcast hits the World Wide Web, it is automatically downloaded to your device of choice. If you're not on iTunes, you can subscribe at channelpronetwork.com/RSS/CPW, or also follow the link on our show notes pages, and you'll be able to subscribe there in your podcast application of choice. So do that. Go to iTunes or whatever. Leave us some good reviews, a nice rating. That'd be nice. Tell some friends, because, we're fun to listen to, right, folks? Maybe. Don't answer that. Just assume we are and tell people anyway. We are also on the Twitter, at ChannelProSMB. You can follow me, at Matt Whitlock. Cecilia is at SealGal. Spell it, Celia.
CEILGAL.
And Mr. Rich is at Rich Free. You don't have to spell it. I think people can figure that one out.
Probably.
Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/channelpronetwork. As always, you can read about all of the stuff that we talked about here today on our website, channelpronetwork.com. Find the show notes there for this episode, and you'll be able to find links to all kinds of stuff to read and keep you busy and entertained. So with that is the end of episode 16. So I want to say thank you for listening. If you have any comments, send us an email, podcast@channelpronetwork.com. We will see you next week.